Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but the Christians you meet are so pushy. They share the gospel of salvation even when you never requested to hear it. They act like they've arrived to help you when you never asked for any help. They offer Jesus as the answer, but you haven't articulated any question. And they point out things about your life when you don't need some busybody pointing out things in your life. In fact, that annoys the snot out of you. Well, my friend, I'm on your side. Christians are not supposed to be offering unsolicited advice. We are here to feed the hungry. By that, I mean spiritually hungry. We're here to feed the hungry, not to make people hungry who aren't hungry. When people stopped listening to Jesus, when the crowds got thinner, he did not chase after them. We do well to follow his example. Now, Jesus is the Savior of the world, and in some polite manner, we do need to at least let people know somehow that a relationship with God is available to them. But if they don't want to talk about it, I'm not interested in trying to make a person do something he really doesn't want to do. For what it's worth, Christians are just as pushy with fellow Christians as they are with people who don't share the faith. Can I say something to you in love, brother? If you're a Christian, those are familiar words. You have heard them often. You have also discovered that your fellow Christians tend to shroud things in spirituality. They seldom, if ever, take responsibility for their own actions. Everything is spirit-led or directed by God or inspired. Sometimes the ruder they are, the more spiritual we deem them. Sometimes raw, unbridled bluntness is viewed with the status of prophecy. Our response, of course, is also scripted. If somebody asks if they can say something in love, we're supposed to say, sure. Yeah, sure. Go ahead. After all, to do otherwise is to quench the spirit. To challenge the statement is to disobey God. It is simply impossible that this person is sharing with us because they like to hear themselves talk or because they enjoy meddling into matters that are none of their business. No, if they took the time to confront you, rest assured they were led by the Lord. Over the years, I've developed a response to this question. Can I say something to you in love? My response is no. That's right, no. After their jaws drop down to their shoes, surprised at my sudden lapse of spirituality, I explain. If you need to preface your comment like that, I know it is not something I'm going to want to hear. I'm sure I can use a lot of advice to straighten out my life, but I would prefer to ask for the critique myself. I no longer accept unsolicited advice, so no, you cannot say what you want to say, not even in love. We'll discuss more problems within the religion of Christianity as I continue my series that I started a few weeks ago on being an equal opportunity complainer, willing to critique even those who share my beliefs. We also have a great guest today, an attorney who will talk, among other things, about the recent Supreme Court ruling regarding same-sex marriage and some ideas of what can be done to reverse this. Ideas that are actually found right in the United States Constitution. Isn't it always the last place you look? All coming up later on in today's program, but first, the latest news. On Tuesday, President Obama commented on his chances of winning a third term if he were allowed to run a third term. I actually think I'm a pretty good president. I think if I ran, I could win, but I can't. There's a lot that I'd like to do to keep America moving, but the law is the law, and no person is above the law, not even the president. Now, frankly, ladies and gentlemen, it's the last part of that speech which concerns me. I always get nervous when Obama reminds us that he is not above the law, because he doesn't really believe that for a second. You see, this president thinks he is above the law. And the last time he talked about wanting to do something but not being able to because of the law, it was when he mentioned that the Constitution didn't give him the right to grant amnesty to millions of illegal aliens. But as you know, he has since granted such amnesty. Some people won't call it amnesty. Call it whatever you want. It's amnesty. And he's hoping people will forget his earlier statement that it's unconstitutional. Many are concerned that this president will not step down from office, not even after 2016. It's not just some conspiracy theory entertained by wackos. Republican candidate Ben Carson, a very intelligent, very capable, very sensible man, has suggested the same thing. I tend to agree. Now, I know, I've heard from those of you who said it could never happen. Bob, it could never happen. Never will happen. I also heard about what couldn't happen back in 2012. All the conservative pundits were telling us at that time that no president had ever won re-election with the economy so bad. This was going to be a slam dunk for Republicans. Couldn't happen. There won't be four more years of Obama. I responded to that conventional wisdom at that time on this radio show and in an article that I wrote for Washington Times Communities. I pointed out how Obama had already beat the odds, that he's the Teflon president with these things. And he beat those odds when he was first elected president back in 2008. At that time, we could have said that no one had ever won an election after voting for infanticide, as he did by refusing to get behind the Illinois Infant Protection Act. Nobody had ever won the presidency by kicking off his political career in the home of a proud, unashamed, self-professed terrorist, such as Obama did in the home of Bill Ayers. That nobody had ever won an election after staying for 20 years in the church of a racist, American-hating pastor like Jeremiah Wright. That no man could win the presidency after openly admitting that he wanted a socialist, wealth-redistributing country, as Obama did in his town hall conversation with Joe the Plumber. That was just 2008. There was a lot more on his record prior to the re-election of 2012. Who could get re-elected after lying about what happened in Benghazi, pretending that four Americans are dead because of a video, that this was just some spontaneous violence, that it had nothing to do with al-Qaeda? The facts have proven otherwise. It did have to do with al-Qaeda, and the facts are showing us that either this was an incompetent State Department or something even worse being covered up. Or who could get reelected in the face of Fast and Furious? And then after 2012, after he got reelected, he's been caught lying about health care, lying about the IRS standard. It goes on and on and on and on. His supporters don't care. They don't give a rip. So who's to say that President Obama won't decide to make the White House his permanent address? He could declare martial law. That's no stretch of the imagination, in as much as his Department of Homeland Security lists as pools for the breeding of terrorism pro-life advocates, those concerned about our borders, and those who do not like this current president. Between ISIS attacking and Obama responding by saying that we are not at war with Muslim terrorists, but rather all terrorists, terrorists being defined as people who disagree with him. Well, what exactly do you think is beyond this president? Some, of course, will point out that the term martial law is not even found in our Constitution. Others say we don't need to see the actual words and that the right to suspend habeas corpus includes the notion of martial law, even though it's supposed to be done with the consent of Congress. But that debate assumes Obama feels the need to find constitutional justification in the first place. A man who thinks the Constitution is inconvenient is not going to strain himself too much in an effort to locate constitutional justification. Besides, who's to say he won't just try to find some judge to rule that a third term is constitutional? Of course, the Constitution doesn't actually say that. In fact, the Constitution says the opposite. But if you've been following the recent trend, there are many judges today who don't seem to care what the Constitution actually says. They're here to tell you what it means. Look, I'm not saying he would succeed. Even if Obama declared martial law, who knows if today's army would back him? Today's army's not that fond of him. And at the end of the day, his desire to continue as president, or lack thereof, may be decided with factors no greater than how nice the golf course is starting to look. But there is nothing about this man which leads me to believe that he isn't at least considering it. If he made the attempt, could he get away with it? You better believe he could get away with it, and for several reasons. A lot of people are stupid. A lot of people don't care anymore what's constitutional, and a lot of people don't care anymore what's ethical. Look at those videos that have come forth regarding Planned Parenthood. People shamelessly admitting that they are selling baby body parts for profit while enjoying a salad, talking as casually as if the subject was a manicure. No real surprises here, in as much as Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, believed in genetic breeding and superior races. She even published an article by Adolf Hitler's eugenicist. And how does our legal system respond to these videos? Well, one federal judge has forbidden further videos to come forth. And in our golden state of California, Attorney General Kamala Harris says she plans to investigate those who made the videos. Not Planned Parenthood, mind you, those who exposed Planned Parenthood, to see if they broke any laws. And how does the mainstream media respond? Well, for the most part, they've ignored the story, and they're concentrating instead on a dentist who went hunting and shot Cecil the Lion. The head of PETA called for the hunter to be hanged. Later on the Michael Medved show, she tried to walk it back by explaining she didn't mean it literally. Oh, of course not. She didn't mean the guy should be hanged. She only meant that the guy should be hanged. Planned Parenthood is doing the kind of stuff Nazis like Joseph Mengele did. And we're concerned about a lion? I know there are allegations that poaching went on, and I'm not saying this particular animal should have been shot. I like animals. I even like felines. I'm a cat lover. I own a pet cat. I just finished publishing a fantasy novel that includes a sub-story about a pet cat, but for crying out loud, it's just a lion, people. It's just a stupid lion.
Here, here. Go away and let us alone.
Oh, scared, huh? Afraid, huh? How long can you stay fresh in that can? Come on, get up and fight, you shivering junkyard. Put your hands up, you lopsided bag of hay.
Now, that's getting personal, lion.
Yes. Get up and teach him a lesson.
Well, what's wrong with you teaching him?
Well, I hardly know him.
Well, I'll get you anyway, Pee-wee.
Shame on you!
What did you do that for? I didn't bite them.
No, but you tried to. It's bad enough picking on a straw man, but when you go around picking on poor little dogs...
Well, you didn't have to go and hit me, did you? Is my nose bleeding?
Lucky thing for Dorothy that PETA never visited the Land of Oz. They might have called for her arrest. The charge? Giving the cowardly lion a slap on the nose.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net. When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at wisdomworkschristianpreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. wisdomworkschristianpreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
I didn't go to pastors' meetings. That's right. I was a pastor, but I did not go to pastors' meetings. I used to say that I couldn't. I'd make excuses. I was too busy. True enough, but not the real reason. Eventually, I gave up on the right-sounding answer. Instead, I waved the white towel of truth. The reason I didn't go to pastors' meetings is that I didn't like them. Nothing holy, nothing spiritual. I simply didn't like them. If you're not a pastor, you probably don't care. But the pastors in my local Baptist affiliation cared very much. I didn't hear from all of them, but I caught enough riffraff through the grapevine to guess that my lack of attendance at the monthly breakfast was interpreted as disinterest in the denomination at the very least, and an unwillingness for accountability at the very most. Wrong on both accounts. I do need accountability, and I liked the conservative Baptist movement, at least enough to represent them as a national evangelist, visiting and ministering to Baptist churches from coast to coast, something I did for many years. Why then did I not like the pastor's fellowship? Because it's not fellowship. It's a time to sit and listen to yet another lecture. When I first became a Christian, I thought I'd committed myself to a lifetime and adventure. An adventure known as the refinement of the soul. In no time at all, I realized that being a Christian actually meant commitment to something else, something seldom discussed and seldom confessed, boredom. I'm sorry you had to hear this from a pastor of all people, but somebody had to say it, Boredom. That time when your mind says, I'll be back to stimulate you in a moment. Can I put you on pause? Between hour-long sermons, seminars, church business meetings, six-session retreats, and pastors' fellowships, I had made an informal, unworded pledge to sit and listen to people talk for the rest of my life. Depressing, isn't it? Now, I wouldn't mind if people honestly had an endless supply of fascinating conversation, but how many times in 12 years can we hear messages from John 16 and Romans 3? How many times in 1 week can we hear about the importance of a quiet time? Quiet time. Gee, that has a nice ring. And don't misunderstand me. Nothing is more important than the gospel. But it seems that in the New Testament, Christian lifestyle consisted of actions, whereas today our lifestyle consists of lectures which talk about actions. Life is awfully short. We spend 8 hours a day sleeping. That's 1/3 of the day, which comes out to 1/3 of our life. I suspect that if we added up the sermons and discussions, we would come up with another third. Frightening. A third of our life sleeping. A third of our life feeling like sleeping. Not that I mind preaching myself. That's different. That's fun. Why? Because when I preach myself, I don't have to listen to anyone else. When I speak, I'm doing something. But alas, my activity is made possible only by turning others numb and docile. Of course, there are exceptions and wonderful speakers. I'm sharing in generalities right now. Sermons and lectures may be a part of the Christian pilgrimage, but I'm convinced they were never meant to be the longest part. On the other hand, genuine accountability and fellowship are exciting, especially when they take place in the midst of family-type community. This is the authentic experience of Christ's kingdom, a sanctuary where masks are dropped, sins are confessed, and unconditional acceptance is offered. Such community is active, not passive. Such community reaches out and demonstrates the love of Jesus. I did experience this community to a substantial degree back when I pastored a church. Our church, like most, I suppose, constantly battled to remain a family and not a social club. Maybe the day will come when pastors' fellowships do the same thing, but I have my doubts. Many pastors feel they can't justify activities unless they include spiritual agendas. And somehow, today's generation has bought the idea that spirituality can't take place without lectures and business meetings. But I have hope that things will change. On that day, maybe I'll return to enjoy a pastor's breakfast and hope they have bacon and eggs to go with the pancakes that they had last time. But the phenomenon of speaking goes beyond small meetings. Let me tell you a story, true story. He was a big name speaker. Yes, indeed, a very big name, but I will not mention his name. He was speaking at the church I attended while in college. It was a big church, and that is why we frequently brought in big speakers. The man had already been preaching for almost an hour when an alarm went off from his watch. He laughed. "My wife gave me this so that I will know when my time is up." After this, he turned off the alarm and continued to preach for at least another 30 minutes. Look, I am a frequent guest speaker in churches myself. I love to talk to an audience. I'll admit it. I have also fallen into the same trap as many of my peers, the erroneous assumption that what we have to say is of such earth-shattering importance that even if we go overtime, few, if any, will care or notice. Indeed, if we are going overtime, it is probably because the Holy Spirit is leading us to do just exactly that due to the unique and critical dynamics of the moment. All utter nonsense. I mean, who are we kidding? Admittedly, an extremely interesting or entertaining speaker may get away with talking longer because the people enjoy him so much they never think to check their watches. But most of the time, an audience would prefer that a sermon end when it's supposed to end. And even when the audience does not feel this way, there's also such a thing as honesty. Yes, far too many of us are dishonest about the time. The church that invited us may have other things to get done during its service. If we are there as a guest, we should honor our original agreement. But that is not generally what happens. When asked to speak for 40 minutes, we plan ahead of time on speaking an hour. When asked to speak for 15 minutes, we take 30 or 40. Not long ago, I was at a conference in which 7 different ministers were asked to lead the audience in prayer. Prayer! They were not even asked to preach at all. They were instructed to state the prayer request, break people into small groups for a few minutes, and then close with a prayer of their own for no more than 2 minutes. Instead, with the exception of one individual, each minister got up and gave a mini sermon. True, he did preach about the prayer subject at hand, but I think we all know that preaching and praying are not the same thing. As a matter of fact, 2 real speakers, men who were actually invited to preach, were scheduled after that prayer meeting, but who wanted to stay around and listen by then? Some of those 2-minute prayers became 10 to 15 minute sermons. Others went for 30 minutes. Why do we let people get away with this? Is it because we consider our leaders to be beyond human failing? The Bible commands us to confess our sins, so I will confess mine. I have often been dishonest with the time allotted. In my defense, I'm getting better. I do try much harder these days, and generally when I go overtime now, it is because I truly did get caught up in the moment and forgot to look at the clock. It is no longer something I dishonestly plan and rationalize. I'll never forget the day I attended a missions conference. I and about 10 others were asked to take 15 minutes to share about our ministries. I went last, following a long litany of speeches, not one of them even close to 15 minutes. Before I began, I said to the audience, "My gift to you this afternoon is that my 15-minute talk will take 15 minutes. A miracle, to be sure, probably up there somewhere with the parting of the Red Sea. Far too often, we assume our leaders and guest speakers are so spiritual that we fail to recognize the more likely truth. At the end of the day, after much discussion about the leading of the Holy Spirit, we often blame the poor Holy Spirit for things he did not do. Some people just enjoy hearing themselves talk. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
What better review of a book than to check with the customers themselves? Here is a recent customer review of Bob Siegel's fantasy novel, The Dangerous Christmas Ornament. Superior. As a middle school teacher, I am a prolific reader of juvenile fiction and an even tougher critic of the genre. With that said, I experienced sheer delight in reading the page-turner, The Dangerous Christmas Ornament by Bob Siegel. Mike, the sixth grade protagonist in the story, is a well-drawn character with all the weaknesses and strengths of a 12-year-old. Mike's e-ticket adventure engages the reader with his shenanigans of making his veggies disappear, cat talk, and creating a twin who doubles for him. Not only that, Bob Siegel skillfully weaves a subtle moral message with the metaphoric thread, which encourages a kid to be the best version of himself, all the while addressing the various angst of preteens. Finally, I was captivated to the last page, but disappointed when the Christmas ride of the magical ornament came to a satisfying conclusion. I can't wait for the sequel. The Dangerous Christmas Ornament, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
This is Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Jesus said that his people should be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. Some churches take that mandate seriously, others, sadly, do not. I am happy to announce that there are many good, serious churches in San Diego, and Skyline is certainly one of them. Outreaches to the community and the world at large are carried on by our missionary family. Their ministries to the poor, the shut-ins, and the emotionally scarred. There are groups and classes for all ages, from children to middle school to high school, college, young adult, and senior citizen. Skyline is also on the cutting edge of today's social issues. We mobilize people and help them to be a better voice for the changing culture around us.
Skyline Church, Sunday morning services at 8:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra. We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net. We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Well, I talked about being honest with the time. I told my guest we'd bring him on at 6:30, and I think we're pretty close, pretty darn close. I would like to welcome back to my program a man that I have had the privilege of interviewing twice before, once on this program and once for Communities Digital News Internet Radio, Dr. Richard A. Nixon, not to be confused with President Richard M. Nixon. We made that joke last time, so we won't belabor the point this time. Dr. Nixon is a practicing attorney in California since 1981 and a Vietnam-era veteran. He has a bachelor's degree in physics and a Juris Doctorate in law. He's author of an important and controversial book entitled America, An Illusion of Freedom. Dr. Nixon, welcome back to our program.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's nice to be back.
It's very nice to have you. And now I know that we've had some recent Supreme Court rulings and other shenanigans and power grabs that seem very unconstitutional. Could you start? I know you did some of this last time, but for those that didn't hear the interview, could you review quickly the job of the Supreme Court as it's laid out in our Constitution and how much power it's supposed to have in relationship to the other two branches of government?
Well, yes. To start with, though, we have to recognize that the sole source of federal power is the U.S. Constitution, which was ratified in 1789. So the federal government looks solely to the Constitution for its power. And when it comes to the judicial officers, whether they be judges or justices, their sole function, frankly, is to effectuate the intention of the legislature. In other words, the judges are not permitted to write the law. They're only permitted to interpret the law that was written by the legislature. And they don't have a choice to whether or not they can enforce the words. They're bound to enforce the words as written. Now, in 1803, there was a case called Marbury versus Madison.
Yes, I was going to ask you to talk about how that changed things.
Yes. In 1803, there was a case called Marbury versus Madison before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, amongst other things, said that it was the sole arbiter of what the Constitution meant. And they assumed the power that the Constitution does not give them. In fact, it was interesting that Chief Justice Marshall, who is apparently the hero of both the left and the right in this country, said very briefly within the Marbury versus Madison case that the powers of the legislature are defined and limited, and that those limits may not be mistaken or forgotten. The Constitution is written. So he made it very clear that if you want to find out whether or not the federal government has a particular power, you just look in the Constitution. And so that you don't forget it and you don't mistake it, it was intentionally written. So if it's not there, you don't have the power. Well, the court assumed a power that it wasn't given, and so it failed to take its own advice. That is to say, the court went on to decide that the act of Congress in that particular case was unconstitutional.
You know, what was ironic is that they actually sided with Jefferson in that case, and yet Jefferson, despite that, had the integrity and the consistency to say that he was still fearful of the kind of power that the court had.
Yes. In fact, Thomas Jefferson was president in 1803. He railed against the fact that the Supreme Court had usurped the power of the legislature by effectively finding things in the Constitution that were not there. And in fact, when there's a debate between who's the stronger of the two branches, that is Congress or the Supreme Court, it's interesting that if we look again, and I for those of you who have constitutions in front of you, you'll be able to follow this much clearer. But Article 3 of the Constitution, which defines judicial power, basically says, and I'll summarize it here, that in all cases before the Supreme Court, when it comes to appellate review, they shall have such appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and to fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. Now, that's called the Exceptions Clause, and basically what that says is that Congress, not the Supreme Court, is in charge between those two. That is to say, Congress passes a law, and if they want to, if they choose to, they can simply say under Article 3, Section 2.2, you, Supreme Court, do not have jurisdiction to hear this case, and therefore they take jurisdiction from the court.
Yeah, and now, it seems like there's even more power given. Isn't it true that in Article 1, Section 1, it says all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which will consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives? And so that seems to be reiterating again that the lawmaking is coming from the legislative branch, not the judicial.
Absolutely. And you see Article 1 that does say all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress. It uses the word all. It doesn't say some. It doesn't say that the Congress shall share these powers with the president or the Supreme Court or the federal branch. It says all legislative powers. So, but the point is, between Congress and the Supreme Court, Congress is in charge, and for good reason, because the founding fathers wanted the people to be in charge of their own destiny, and the Congress is accountable to the people, where the Supreme Court is not. This is why they never intended, for instance, with the Obama cases, Obamacare cases, you have to wait a year, year and a half before the Supreme Court decides whether or not what the Congress did was constitutional. There was no such scheme intended by the founding fathers to make us wait a year and a half to find out if the law was appropriate. The law was intended to be appropriate and immediate. As soon as the Congress had passed it, it became a law, and there was none of this waiting time contemplated by the founding fathers. And again, they reiterated that by their use of Article 3, Section 2.2, that puts Congress in charge.
Now, when I hear people say that the Supreme Court is there to interpret the Constitution, that word concerns me a little bit, and one of the reasons is people don't even necessarily agree as to what that word means in this case. It's almost like we have to interpret the word interpret. Now, if what they mean is that when a new law comes up, the Supreme Court is going to look at that law and see how it measures up to the Constitution, I'm fine. But I think a lot of people, when they hear the word interpret, they're imagining that the Supreme Court is finding some meaning in the Constitution that the rest of us are not capable of seeing.
Well, first of all, the Constitution was written for the lay people to understand.
Exactly.
There is nothing in the Constitution that was intended to be secret. And in fact, if you look at the text and you look at the history, it's very clear that those words speak for themselves. And the problem is that what some people call interpretation is literally rewriting. There's a number of cases that I cite in my book where the Supreme Court literally changed words to suit themselves, and this is not interpretation. Interpretation, of course, is something that judges do all the time. For instance, sometimes the law uses words like reasonable. Well, if the law contains the phrase or the word reasonable, obviously judges have to be able to figure out in that particular case whether this thing is reasonable. So that interpretation is certainly valid.
So they're interpreting the case that comes up, but they're not going back to the Constitution and saying, well, you see that it says this, but we're going to tell you what it really means between the lines.
Well, that's exactly right. And again, now that we get into the power of the legislature, as you had mentioned earlier, all legislative power actually is vested in the Congress. And the next thing that we need to talk about, though, quite frankly, is where does that power reside? And usually, one looks to Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 1 through 17. Now, I realize I'm getting in the weeds here just a bit, but the point is that part of Article 1, Section 8 discusses what has been called the enumerated powers. That is, there's 17 items that the federal government was permitted to do, and it was not permitted to do more. That was the whole point, that the founding fathers were jealous of their power. They only created this federal government monster, as many of them called it, because some things were necessarily genuine or general or national in character. They intended to give no other powers to them. And of course, that's confirmed by the 10th Amendment, which was ratified in 1791, which says, again, briefly, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or the people. So the 10th Amendment made it very clear that if the Constitution did not give give a power to the federal government did not have that specific power. All the power resided in the states and the people.
It almost seems like state rights don't even exist anymore.
Well, that's right. But you see, once the Supreme Court in the Marbury versus Madison case had declared that it was in effect in charge of Congress, because if it liked what Congress passed as a law, it would simply say it's constitutional. If they didn't like it, they would find some reason for why it violated the Constitution.
Yeah.
But you see, what happened is eventually the Supreme Court said, what are we going to do about the states, though? The states have all this freedom, and we're in control of Congress, but we've got to figure out a way of controlling the states now as well. And again, I know I'm getting a little bit deep here. But
that's okay.
We have to talk, at this point, we have to talk about the 14th Amendment. And what it does is it discusses citizenship, due process, and equal protection. And basically what the 14th Amendment talks, now remember, the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868. It was ratified just after the Civil War, and its basic purpose was to elevate the then slaves to now free people. So it was intended to, that was their sole purpose, was to elevate the former slaves to non-slave status. And so the 14th Amendment literally addresses the states. It says, for instance, in the Due Process Clause, it says that no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Now, all that meant was that from this point forward, every state had to have some kind of set procedure by which they could take a person's life, liberty, or property. They had to have some kind of procedure. Now, interestingly enough, that's a tacit approval of the death penalty. I mean, again, this is not something we necessarily intended to talk about today, but by mentioning the Due Process Clause, the Constitution is basically saying that's up to the state. If you're going to take a person's life, liberty, and property, or a property, you must have a procedure. Now, the reason I keep stressing this due process is this. Eventually, the courts said, and this goes back to, well, it goes to the 1930s, they took the word due process out of the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause and said, well, we think it means more than procedure, or in fact, what we think it means is that the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, will now start applying to the states. Now, you'll recall that the Bill of Rights, starting with the First Amendment, actually was only intended to apply to the federal government, because the first word of the First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law regarding the restriction of religion and so on. It says exactly, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So the Bill of Rights were only prohibitions against the federal government. It doesn't say Congress and or the states. It simply says Congress.
Now, let me ask you a question. How would that work, like with the other part of the First Amendment, like free speech? Because obviously for somebody to speak freely, that's a right granted by the federal government, but he's also going to be speaking in whatever state he resides in. So how would those two mesh together?
Well, you see, that's the point. They really don't, because the court just forces, they put a square peg in a round hole, and that's how they declare it, and it's over. But that's a good point, because it does say here, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Now, the word abridge means to limit. So what they intended to do with the first 10 amendments, that is the Bill of Rights, was to absolutely prohibit the federal government from doing anything regarding religion, freedom of speech, freedom of press, etc. So this was not a limited prohibition against the federal government. It was absolute. But notice, it doesn't mention the states. The states were still free to fashion their own laws regarding religion, freedom of speech, freedom
right.
of press.
Right, so they'd have to come up with their own Bill of Rights, you're saying.
Exactly, and every state did. In fact, our U.S. Constitution came from an amalgam from New York and Virginia and several other then-existing constitutions. So there was nothing new there, but the main point is it's clear from the words and the history that the Bill of Rights was never intended to apply to the states. But as I said, the Supreme Court needed a way to start controlling the states so they could micromanage what they did. And the way they found it was to take the words due process by applying Orwellian logic as opposed to classical logic. They took the words due process and said, you know what, from now on, due process means we're going to start applying the Bill of Rights to the states.
Now, what case did that happen? Marbury versus Madison obviously opened up Pandora's box. What other cases started giving the Supreme Court even further power?
Well, there's a case called Adamson versus California, 1947, where the justices are discussing just that. How are we going to start? By what means are we going to now start applying the Bill of Rights to the states? And Justice Frankfurter had something very interesting to say. He said, well, let me ask you, my brothers here, something here. By what calculus do you determine what part of the Bill of Rights applies to the states? Well, of course, they had no criteria. They would simply come back with another answer like, well, if it's a fundamental right, then it's protected by the Constitution and we must include it in the Bill of Rights and we must apply it to the states. And he said, well, fine, then what's the calculus for determining that? So if I know what's in and what's out, well, they have no answer to that. So as years have gone by, they've simply taken certain things and by their own definitions, they've simply said, well, we think that this right is fundamental, maybe the Fourth Amendment search and seizure. We think that's fundamental. Therefore, we're now going to apply that to the states, and the Supreme Court now can micromanage every state's constitution and every state's laws, because now they have elevated themselves to be the final gatekeeper of what each state can do.
Okay, let's talk in the present day. How much respect do you think our current president has for our Constitution? How would you evaluate his track record at this point?
Well, he has no respect, but you see, he's an ex-professor, and he knows, quite frankly, that he can basically do what he wants to do. And by the time people catch up with him, he'll be out
of the horse is out of the corral by then.
Exactly. So I think he has very little respect for it, and I think he, quite frankly, doesn't understand portions of it. He looks at the Bill of Rights as authority for the federal government, when in fact it's the opposite. It's authority prohibited to the federal government.
Yeah, I think he has more respect for a napkin than he has for the paper that our Constitution was written on.
Well, that's interesting. And again, when we allow the Supreme Court to micromanage the states, is what I state very briefly here on page 100 of my book. And I just want to cite two little minor cases here. I shouldn't say minor. They're very brief, but they're very, very important. And one of them, for instance, says this, that it's on page 100 of my book. In 1967, the court outlawed a nursery rhyme which did not mention the word God. The court held that even though the word God was not mentioned in the nursery rhyme, if someone were to hear it, it might cause them to think of God, and it is therefore unconstitutional. Now, how
it staggers the imagination.
It's unbelievable that our justices would have such an opinion. And in 1980, this is the last one, it's Stone versus Graham. The court held that the posting of the Ten Commandments in our public schools was illegal. The court held that if the posted copies of the Ten Commandments are to have any effect at all, it will be to induce the school children to read them. And if they read them, they may meditate upon them and perhaps venerate and obey them. This is not a permissible objective. Imagine, the Ten Commandments are not permissible under the Constitution. It's just unbelievable.
Especially when they were part of the basis for our Constitution in the first place.
Exactly. And my point is that this is exactly what happens when you allow, or what we have allowed, the Supreme Court to take over the states as well as the Congress. But there are ways to correct this.
Yeah, and I know that you wanted to talk about that. The 14th Amendment, I'm assuming you believe that Obama's amnesty is a complete violation of that 14th Amendment.
Absolutely.
It says that citizenship decisions are in the hands of the Congress.
Well, now when we get to the 14th Amendment, as we said earlier, it discusses three things: citizenship, due process, and equal protection. But we forgot one thing. That was in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. If you go to Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, there's something very interesting about this. And the Founding Fathers were actually, this was not the Founding Fathers, this was 1868. But the drafters of the 14th Amendment were very wise, because they said in Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, the Congress shall have power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. And so what that means basically is that Congress can, if you will, flesh in the words citizenship, due process, equal protection. It can, if it chooses to, and it's done it in the past, define these words for us. And what I'm proposing, which I haven't read in any other book, is that we literally demand that Congress redefine the 14th Amendment, citizenship, due process, and equal protection, as originally intended. And, you know, we're not asking for much. We're asking that our government give us what was promised us. We were promised a constitution that says what it says. We were not promised some kind of a oligarchy consisting of 9 unelected Supreme Court justices who would rewrite this thing for us. We never bargained for that.
And that makes perfect sense to me. But these days, anybody who starts talking about the Constitution is viewed as some kind of fanatic.
Well, that's because the Supreme Court and the teachers from Harvard and Yale and so on have decided that we want it. They like the practice as it is now, because it's plausible deniability. You have Congress passing a law, and you have in many cases, in our Obamacare cases, eventually the Supreme Court makes a decision. People were mad at Justice Roberts for saying it was constitutional. And so instead of railing against Congress that passed the law, they rail against Justice Roberts. And so that's exactly what they want. They want us to go after someone who or somebody that is not accountable to us instead of holding Congress accountable, because they are accountable to us.
Well, what proves that the judges aren't just reading the Constitution anymore is when we're having an election, we always say, well, we have to put in a Democrat or Republican so that he can appoint conservative justices or liberal justices. Well, the justices shouldn't be conservative or liberal. They're just there to enforce this document, not to insert their opinion in the middle of it.
Exactly. And see, it calls up the question. President Eisenhower used to talk about the military-industrial complex. What I'm concerned with, frankly, is how long we're going to put up with this Hollywood academia media federal government complex. That's the problem. In other words, everyone has is at the table except the people. Hollywood won't solve this problem. Every movie that you see, or I should say most, are anti-conservative. The academia, they out of Harvard and Yale, the best schools we've got, they teach the same thing, that it's okay for the Supreme Court to rewrite the Constitution. Yeah. And the media doesn't help much.
Well, and we have a Congress right now that promised to confront Obama, but they spend more time worrying about what the New York Times editorial page is going to say about them than keeping their campaign promises. We have a president who thinks Congress's job is to work with him in a bipartisan way, bipartisan being defined as whatever he wants to do. So I agree with you that the Congress has the right to do this. I have zero hope that they're actually going to do it.
Okay, well, again, what I think is unique about my book is I do cut to the chase. Most books talk about how we're going to deal with the cases as they exist, how we can insert a new argument, and maybe the courts will do something different in the ensuing cases. But what I do is I cast aside all those cases and I talk about the Constitution itself. And the only thing we do is we contact our congressmen, because they are accountable to us, and we simply threaten them. And what I mean by threat is simply threaten to take their job from them if they don't do the following. Now, and I'm going to, maybe this would be a little bit complicated here, but again, we talked about the 14th Amendment, citizenship, due process, and equal protection. And if we use Section 5, which authorizes Congress to, if you will, flesh in those definitions, we demand that Congress redefine those terms as originally intended. So in order to be a citizen based on birth, you must be a child of parents who were both citizens here at the time of the birth. And that actually says it here when they say all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. That phrase, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, doesn't mean simply that you're here physically. It means that you, as a child, were not subject to another government's subject to another government. That is to say, your parents are here and they are here as citizens of the United States. So, for instance, if mom and dad come here from France and mother has a baby, it was never intended that that baby be an American. That baby is a Frenchman for all intents and purposes. And what the court does, though, is they eliminate that phrase, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, and simply read it as, if you're born here, you're a citizen.
And how about the interpretation of equal protection regarding the Supreme Court's recent decision about same-sex marriage?
Exactly. Equal protection, again, 14th Amendment, 1868, was intended to, for one reason, that was to make the former slave equal to the non-slave. It was never intended to apply to anything else. So if Congress, using Section 5, redefines those words as originally intended, that is to say that equal protection will apply to just what it was intended to apply to in the beginning, that is slavery and elevating the non-slave to the level of a non-slave, that would be the new definition. And any cases brought on equal protection, due process, citizenship would now be bound by the new law that Congress just passed. Now, here's the problem, if there is a problem. We have to threaten Congress that if they don't do that, we're going to vote against them.
Okay, and that means we're running out of time. That means those of you in Nancy Pelosi's district, you might have to explain to her what the Constitution is first, but threaten her to remove her of her job. Dr. Nixon, thank you so much for coming on our show. Dr. Richard A. Nixon, author of America, An Illusion of Freedom. I assume people can find that book on Amazon?
Yes, absolutely. And please read the Constitution when you've got my book in hand.
Okay. Thank you so much. We'll see you next week, everybody.
Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.